gets into the regulative principles and starts getting very interesting in terms of the actual essence of the process. So, let's see. We'll quickly go over the questions and then we'll begin. So, there are 5 questions from last time. Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutanay Shamati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswami Devi Gauravani Pacharine Nevishesha Shunyavadi Pastyate Desatayane Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Pramitananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sivasari Gaur Vyakti Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So this one, next, this chapter is 5, called The Purity of Devotional Service. And we were not able to read the chapter last time, so now we just have to go back over these few questions and just as a review to help us remember this chapter. So the first question is, explain how every living being has a right to perform devotional service and, on the basis, how the Krishna conscious movement is making this practice a policy worldwide. Okay, so that's an easy question. How every living being has the right to perform devotional service. Who wants to answer that question? Okay.
The devotional service is not restricted to a particular class of men. It is open for all because it is the natural positional constitution of all living entities.
Right. So it is the natural constitutional position for all living entities to engage in devotional service. Jivya Siddhu Boya Nitya Krishna Das Nitya Siddhu Krishna Prema Sarukhava Noi Shravanadi Siddhi Chitti Kodiya Yudhoi. These 2 verses, one is that all the living entities are internal parts and parcels of Krishna, and the other one is all living entities have a natural loving relationship with the Lord as their innate quality of the soul. Now, based on this principle, how is the Krishna conscious movement practicing this worldwide?
Well, the Krishna conscious movement is a accepted member from all sections of society.
All sections of society. And without restriction?
Yes.
So previously, or traditionally, we might say this was not true because it's mentioned in this. In this discussion, in the waves of devotion, there is reference to one particular fight in which Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, it's mentioned, it's a nice historical account, it doesn't mention the account, but it was in 1911 at a place called Midnapur. Bhakti Siddhanta, on behalf of his father, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, went and it was a public debate, and he spoke on the position of Vaishnavas, and then there were so many Brahmins there. So what was higher, Vaishnava or Brahman? So basically, based on that thing, it was explained that a Brahmin is not simply, you know, a Brahmin by birth, but by qualification. And one who becomes a Vaishnava, he has all Brahminical qualities, because a Vaishnava is the actual higher position, because unless a Brahmin can teach and become Krishna conscious himself, he's not really a Brahmin. So there was an interesting debate. It turned out for 3 days, and it completely, here it says, Bhakti the powerful Chari completely smashed their ideas. Siddhanta was very strong on this principle that it's not relegated to a particular class, caste. Even women were not allowed to practice devotional service. Even Srila Prabhupada showed that not only can women practice devotional service, but they can also take brahminical initiation and also engage in worshiping the deity. So all these restrictions based on position. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that any, you know, women, sudras, vaishyas, anyone who takes the process can attain to the highest perfectional stage, provided they follow the process as given. And Srila Prabhupada has demonstrated that around the world by relieving all the caste and what we say, you know, the ecclesiastical restrictions that were there in the Vedic culture. Still today, Prabhupada is criticized for doing that, but we see the results. The results are that people are taking up Krishna consciousness, giving up their sinful activities, and actually becoming lovers of God. So the proof is in the pudding. And Srila Prabhupada proved it based on Shastra and based on, you know, the purity of devotional service. Okay. Any points, discussion on that question? Second question. Initiation by a bona fide spiritual master in one's endeavor to perform devotional service properly. Which of these two are most important?
Let me answer.
Yeah.
One's endeavor to follow the rules and regulations very carefully is more important than initiation, because if one does not follow the rules and regulations, then he is again fallen. Simply becoming initiated does not elevate one to the position of a high-class brahmana. One has to discharge the duties and follow the regulative principles very rigidly.
Yeah. What page did you find that on?
Yeah, 48, 49, I believe. Mm. Yeah, the bottom of 49. 48.
Yeah.
I put the bowl on the bottom.
Let's see, bowl.
Yeah, that was my initial response.
Where is it, what does it say? What you were just saying?
The paragraph starts with Sri Rupa Goswami. That's what the paragraph starts with. If you
that a person is probably, he should not think that simply by one still has to follow the rule of the way, accepting the spiritual. I think the answer is both.
Yeah.
Because if one follows the rules and regulations but is not initiated and not connected to the parampara, they can make some little advancement. But I think both are important.
You know what you mentioned before, if you say that without initiation, the actual connection with Krishna doesn't take place?
Yeah, after a certain time. One can practice devotional service up to a certain point, and then through that practice, Krishna reveals the next step. At one stage, one must make that step. If one doesn't make that step, then they don't make any further advancement until they make that step. And Krishna says, as one is looking for me, I guide them to my representative. So Krishna is guiding one towards the representative. But if one doesn't make that next step, then one will not make any further advancement. So it's a process of always moving forward and trying to understand what is the next step. See, but each of these are dependent on each other. Because one cannot really endeavor to perform devotional service properly unless they have guidance from a bona fide spiritual master. And initiation by a spiritual master precludes performing devotional service properly. So both, I think, are important. Okay. Okay. it's important to understand the importance of initiation. As without initiation, of course, the holy name is not dependent on initiation, but at a certain point, by chanting the holy name, the holy name will reveal that that is the next step. This is a process of going step by step, and then the third step is initiation. It's Adal Stradha, Sadhu Sangha, Bhajana Kriya. So Adal Stradha means faith, and from faith comes Sadhu Sangha, association with devotees. And from that comes, through association with devotees, one actually accepts initiation, and then the next, from there comes Anartya Vritti. So Prabhupada, in his initiation lectures, he says this initiation is the third of the nine stages in bhakti. So there are nine stages, initiation is the third stage. One cannot move into the fourth stage unless we think go to the third stage. And the fourth stage means unwanted desires in the heart are still there, and they are removed by the process of devotional service, but they also are removed by the mercy of the spiritual master. So one must take shelter. And we'll see that in the next chapter. We'll make all this clear. It's explained very nicely. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, number three, explain the mystery of the devotional cult. Unfortunately, I didn't do my homework this time. Because I had to go out today. Explain the mystery of the devotional cult.
The mystery is that if one who is engaged in devotional service and circumstantially falls down from the principles of devotional service, he need not take to the parachita performances for reformation. He simply has to execute the rules and regulations for discharging devotional service.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, there's no atonement necessary. Praischitya means atonement. So if one falls or slips from the process, the way to get back up is simply to engage in the process once again. There's no need for any other activity as far as atonement for one's. One has to do two things. One has to stop doing those things which caused them to fall down, and one has to take up the process sincerely. So that's the mystery. The mystery of devotional service here is the answer is. Devotional service is the atonement.
The process itself is
the atonement. In other words, there's nothing needed for atonement. You just regain the process, resume the process. That is the atonement.
Can we? This is no controversial, but can be understood in a bad way, because one can practice devotional service and have many fall downs and think that it is okay because practicing devotional service.
But that's if one accidentally falls down, then it's okay. But then if one becomes one purposely thinks that I can do something sinful or outside of the process, then that's the set of offense to the holy name, which is commit sinful activities on the strength of the holy name. And thinking that I can be relieved of the sin simply by the process of chanting. So Prabhupada said if you slip, yes. But again, we might also say if one keeps slipping and then coming back, then that's also a sense of insincerity. Or one is not as insincerity or not serious about taking up the process again. Because if you make a mistake or you slip, we should see what caused that or what do I need to avoid. and you correct that, and then you get back into the process again. And if it happens again, that's okay. I mean, and you can do it again. But if it happens over and over again, one is developing a wrong mentality. So in other words, you can't just, you know, just keep getting back up and go. Because each time you fall down, it gets harder to get back up.
Even so, don't you think the Lord is so much stronger? Because I have a sensation of a young man who does that, and he falls down, but he's so attracted to the Lord, and he's coming back and coming back and coming back. He wants very much to succeed, and he doesn't make any excuses for himself, but he keeps falling down.
Yeah, well, the process is that one has to avoid those things which cause one to fall, or one needs to take up the association of devotees. Because in the association, one gets the knowledge, one gets the strength. What is the use of, you know, falling down, getting up, falling down, getting up, falling? After a while, you won't get up anymore. You become so discouraged.
Well, he's not really discouraged.
It will happen.
He's stuck.
Well, the stuck is, what does he have to do to get unstuck?
He needs the association more regularly, instead of once in a while.
Yeah, that's the problem. So, unless they accept that, then association of the devotees is the mercy of the Lord. So he's rejecting the mercy of the Lord, so how can he get the mercy of the Lord? It's not like the mercy of the Lord is separate from, you know, the thing that will cure him. It's like the mercy of the doctor is the medicine. But if you don't take the medicine, then what is the mercy? Yeah. So we have to somehow or other learn to avoid those things which cause us to fall down. If we're serious, if we're not serious, or if we're too much attached to something. Like, I get letters all the time. People say, I just can't give it up. I said, well, ultimately, you have to, otherwise you're not going to make any more advancement.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to make any advancement, it means you're not going to get the taste. And without the taste, how can you continue? Okay. This is the mystery of devotion. The mystery of devotional service is itself purifying. Okay, briefly explain the three processes of elevation to the platform of spiritual consciousness and explain how devotional service is topmost. Okay, Jerry.
The three processes of elevation are karma, jnana, and bhakti. Karma is the ritualistic performances, while jnana is the speculative process. Both of these processes are included in the path of bhakti. We perform karma based on our knowledge of the ultimate goal, which is bhakti. From the Srimad Bhagavatam and other Vedic scriptures, we learn further that if a person simply acts in Krishna consciousness and discharges devotional service, he is considered to be far, far better situated than all of those persons engaged in philanthropic, ethical, moral, altruistic, and social welfare activities.
Mm-hmm.
I got this actually from a class. Well, some of this was out of the book, but the Srila was talking in the Gita class last night that this part here, that we perform our karma through ritualist activities based on jnana, which is knowledge.
Jnana.
Of the ultimate goal.
Jnana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But in the understanding point of theory, in the context of the chapter, I think that it's trying to point out that the devotional service has nothing to do with karma and jnana.
It's karma and jnana, but karma and jnana is included in bhakti. In other words, bhakti is not dependent on karma and jnana.
Pure bhakti.
Yeah. One who takes up the process of bhakti, that verse. Bahunam jnanamam One who is in knowledge, gyan leads to bhakti. But once one attains bhakti, gyan is included. And it also mentions in the Nectar Devotion that when one begins the devotional service, a little bit of cultivation of gyan and a little bit of cultivation of vairagya is necessary in order to get a foothold. In other words, in the beginning one has to give up certain activities. One has to cultivate the knowledge of their relationship with the Lord. And then once one performs the process automatically gives that knowledge. As Krishna says in, or it's mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam, by rendering devotional service, causeless knowledge and detachment automatically occur. So, through the process of pleasing Krishna, one gets knowledge. And through the process of pleasing Krishna, one also gets receive renunciation.
Hmm. Well, that's, when we speak of devotional service free of jnana and karma, we refer to speculative knowledge. On karma, but with
not
in order to reap some material gain.
Yeah, well, that's the verse Anya Bislat Sita Sunya Jnana Kamalavita Anukulena Krishna Sivana Bhakti Uttar. That philosophical speculation on the absolute truth for gain. In other words, one is studying the books in order not to advance in devotional service, but to achieve some position within the ranks of knowledge, to be known as a scholar, or to use that knowledge for some kind of gain within one's life. So that is philosophical knowledge with the desire for gain. And karma is fruit of activities. In other words, one does something in order to get a result from that. But bhakti is free from all that. Bhakti means you perform the service for the pleasure of the Lord. That's all.
So the knowledge and karma of bhakti, Jerry was saying, is different from that jnana and karma that Rupa Goswami
That knowledge is actually bhakti itself. Transcendental knowledge is bhakti, not jnana. Jnana is philosophical speculation, really. The absolute truth. Trying to understand the absolute truth through philosophy. And one can get to the certain, one can actually reach a certain level, but then at that one point, knowledge becomes no more, what would you say, beneficial, and one has to surrender. That's the verse in Gita. One has to surrender to Krishna when they have achieved enough philosophical knowledge. What is that philosophical knowledge? It is that I am a servant of Krishna. And but if I don't serve, then the knowledge is useless.
One more question. When we refer to like this kind of jnana, we also are referring to the impersonal understanding of that as jnana.
In this reference here?
Yes, in the context that bhakti doesn't have anything of jnana.
Yeah, that's also referring to that kind of jnana. That kind of jnana that the impersonalists are called jnanas. Yeah, they're called jnanas. Yeah. The impersonalists are called jnanas because they don't render service. As soon as you begin service, you're in the practice part. You're in the area of bhakti. So bhakti begins when one takes shelter of a bona fide spiritual master and executes his will. Then you begin bhakti. Before then, it's all speculative knowledge, which is hopefully bringing you to the classroom of surrender. Once you get in bhakti, Prabhupada also says that if one simply chants Hare Krishna and serves the Lord, that's sufficient. But if one wants to cultivate philosophical knowledge along with that, that may be useful for preaching. It may also be useful for understanding more about the nature of the world. It's important, but at the same time, it's not that one cannot become Krishna conscious if they don't. One has full faith in the process, full faith in the spiritual master, and chants the holy name. That's enough. But in Kali Yuga, it's so hard. We need this knowledge. So you see the difference? Bhakti, you know, and it's mentioned in that converted devotion that you need a little bit of jnana and a little bit of vairagya in the beginning. Because if you don't perform a little bit of jnana and a little bit of vairagya, you somehow or other can't get a foothold in bhakti. You need a cultivation, a little bit of knowledge. Knowledge of that I'm Krishna's servant. The knowledge between, what's the difference between matter and spirit? Basic knowledge. So the body is temporary, the soul is eternal. Okay?
Okay. I want to get on to the next chapter. Let's do the last one. What are the different obligations of a conditioned soul? How does devotional service free one from these obligations? What are the different obligations of devotional? So we discussed that verse from the 11th canto,
11:5:41 or 42.
Yeah.
Want me to read the answer?
Yeah.
A conditioned soul is indebted to the great sages, ancestors, living entities, family, and society. Devotional service frees one from all obligations because devotees are under the protection of Krishna. Krishna is the source of everything, so by serving him, the devotee serves the roots of the trees and the branches, which represent the other obligations, are automatically satisfied.
So, when one is born into this world, they have obligations to family, to society, because society is providing certain things for your livelihood. Family is giving you your body. One has obligations to the great sages who give transcendental, who give knowledge. The demigods who provide material resources. So all these are what we say debts or a debtor. So that's why everyone has to work hard in order to pay back their debts or fulfill certain obligations. Family obligation, social obligation, political obligation. You know, this obligation, that obligation. But devotional service serves the source of everything, the Supreme Lord, so therefore all other obligations are automatically taken care of simply by the process of devotional service. People criticize and say, well, what are you people doing for society? You're copping out, you're becoming parasites. But I say, no, actually you're not. We're providing the highest benefit to society. We're giving transcendental knowledge. And we're not parasites because we're living by the grace of our Father, who is Krishna, not on the grace of the social or political arrangements. We are not dependent on those. We are dependent on Krishna. So, and this is a very important, I say out of all the questions, this is probably one of the most important, because devotees somehow think they have so many other obligations. But the only obligation is to engage in devotional service. Because Krishna is the source of everything. When Krishna is satisfied, the water of the tree, the water on the root goes to all parts of the tree.
That is applied only when a devotee is fully engaged. This applies only when a devotee is fully engaged in devotional service?
Good question. It seems like if one is seriously taking up the process, then that is enough. If one is not serious, or one is taking the process up for another motivation, then that may still allow one to still be affected by social and political obligations. In other words, one has to take shelter of Krishna. Even if they're not pure, even if they're not on pure devotional status, but if they fully take shelter of the Supreme Lord, even if they have all material desires, then that applies. As long as they fully take shelter of Krishna, that's all. But if they don't fully take shelter, they take shelter of Krishna sometimes, or in certain circumstances, then that will force them to still have material obligations because they're not dependent on Krishna. Even if you have all the material desires left, it doesn't matter. Simply if you just take shelter of the process, then you're relieved.
So one can say he's practicing devotional service and he did give up his family, and then maybe a member of the family will need help. And he said, he can quote this verse and say, no, I'm practicing devotional service, but he's not fully engaged. You see that?
Yeah, but if he's pleasing Krishna, Krishna will take care of his family members. You see many times. I mean, the story of what was it? There's so many stories in the scriptures. Stories of Sri Haraswami, great renunciate. His wife was pregnant, and he wanted to take sannyas. So he was thinking, when the baby's born, then the mother will have the child, and I'll leave. So when the baby was born, the mother died, and he was stuck with the child. So they didn't know what to do. So then he was thinking, all of a sudden, he saw this lizard. In India, one of these lizards, you see lizards all around. And they fell from the ceiling. He was laying there. And all of a sudden, it's a baby lizard, a tiny little baby lizard. And a little fly was going, it flew right near the lizard, and the lizard just ate the fly. So then he understood. Krishna takes care of everybody. Taking care of this lizard, why didn't he take care of my baby? So he left. Took some yes. So that was the thing, you know. So one has faith that Krishna will take care. Right? It's like you're still somewhat connected with your family. You know, your family actually will gain in all aspects of your life as you make progress in devotional service. The more you become dear to Krishna, the more your family will also get the benefits of that bhava of your devotional service. We see it in the lives of all of our relatives. They all gain by our own devotional service. And some of them actually become devotees because of that. And some of them actually become devotees because their friends or relatives, you know, on devotional service.
And some people don't have to give up their families. The families get them off.
That's easy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, then you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to worry about anything. But then, like, some common cases, you know, I'm going to school, I have to pay back all my school loans. What should I do? He's coming, engage in devotional service, Krishna will take care of everything. You have to understand that as soon as the person surrenders to Krishna, Krishna wipes the slate clean. There's nothing in the past they have to worry about. It's all new. But if they keep looking back, then they create that problem in their own life. Just don't look back. Okay, this is a powerful verse. Devarsi putatma, what is that? Devarsi putatma, vini putrinam.
Natrim karunam, vini charatam.
Yats.
Sarapatmana.
Yats svaranam.
Sharanyam. Gatum Kundam Parikitya.
Kartum. That is the verse from Srimad Bhagavatam. Very important verse. Because people always get stuck with this. I got this obligation. This surrender to Krishna, Krishna will do everything. Okay, so how to discharge devotional service. This is a tremendous chapter. And the next chapter, number 7, explains each of these in detail. Some of them, not all of them. So let's go through these. And this chapter will take a couple of lessons to do.
Okay.
In other words, we'll do it today, and we'll also do it number 6 the next time we meet too. Okay, so we want to read? Begin by reading. Mataji, you want to read the first paragraph?
Sure. Srila Rupa Goswami states that his eldest brother, Sanatana Goswami, has compiled Bhaktivilas for the guidance of the Vaishnavas, and therein has mentioned many rules and regulations to follow for the Vaishnavas. Some of them are very important and prominent, and Srila Rupa Goswami will now mention these very important items for our benefit. The purport of this statement is that Srila Rupa Goswami proposes to mention only basic principles, not details. For example, the basic principle is that one has to accept the spiritual master. Exactly how one follows the instructions of the spiritual master is considered a detail. For example, if one is following the instruction of the spiritual master, and that instruction is different from the instructions of another spiritual master, this is called detailed information. But the basic principle of acceptance of a spiritual master is good everywhere, although the details may be different. Srila Rupa Goswami does not wish to enter into details here, but wants to place before us only the principles.
He mentions the basic principles as follows. So we can go through them. I mean, each one warrants a large explanation. But I don't know how we'll be able to accommodate each one accordingly. So we'll do a synopsis of each, and then we can discuss them. One. What is the first one? Okay. So that is the first principle. Some devotees mistakenly think that the first principle is to get initiated, but that's not. The first one is to accept shelter. Until one accepts shelter, then there's no question of initiation. So that is the preliminary aspect of getting initiated. One must work under the guidance of one of Krishna's bona fide representatives. And accepting shelter means that according to the spiritual master's guidelines for shelter, one executes devotional service. And usually in ISKCON, we say that for approximately 1 year, one takes shelter of a bona fide spiritual master and observes, executes the process, and at the same time considers whether he wants to take that person as his eternal spiritual master. At the same time, the spiritual master also evaluates the qualification of the student and see if he's worthy to be given initiation. So Prabhupada said there's mutual testing. The spiritual master is seeing the qualifications of the disciple. The disciple is seeing he's evaluating his spiritual master to see if that's the person he wants to take. But in that relationship, it's just like if one is initiated, but it's only a preliminary stage. If one decides not to accept the guidance of that particular person, then there is no loss. Nothing is lost, and whatever gain there may be, one can accept that. But once initiation comes, then there's no question
of rejection of the spiritual master as long as the spiritual master remains bona fide. So this is a preliminary stage of mutual testing, and it's essential. Usually the way the process goes is that one practices spiritual devotional service in that temple under the guidance of the temple authorities, and then after some time it starts to look for someone to take shelter of. And then in that process of looking, one will be led by Krishna to someone who is his representative, and then one may take shelter. Sometimes devotees, again, at some point, mistakenly think, I have to get initiation from a person that takes shelter. No. Nor should a spiritual master try to possess someone. He simply tries to do that as a service with them. So accepting the shelter, but usually one who takes shelter and works under the guidance, a relationship develops. Based on that relationship, one is inspired to take initiation. That's the first principle, okay? Second one?
Becoming initiated by a spiritual master and learning how to discharge devotional service from him.
Okay. So after that process matures, then one actually takes initiation. Prabhupada said initiation means beginning. Initiation means beginning. One is beginning the process of bhakti. One is practicing beforehand, and now one is actually beginning. And then one's devotional service is more. We can do so many things, and that's nice. But when we take initiation and we work under the guidance of the spiritual master, when the spiritual master is pleased, then Krishna is pleased. We know exactly how we're progressing, whether the spiritual master is pleased. And learning how to discharge devotional service. The spiritual master has two aspects to his vakya, his words, that is philosophical knowledge and personal guidance. Two aspects. He gives personal guidance on what service he might want you to do and how to do it. And he also gives philosophical knowledge based on scriptures, both. So that's spiritual master. Okay, any questions on that? Yeah?
In our ISKCON, there are many spiritual masters, but not always we receive, we learn to discharge the devotional service exactly for the Diksha Guru. Sometimes from the Shiksha Guru. Because we are working under the authorities, and we are.
Yeah, but that's explained in the scriptures. The Diksha and Shiksha should not be different. And one can take shelter of a Shiksha Guru with the approval of a Diksha Guru. And then if there's any difference in the instructions, then one must accept the principle of Diksha. But generally, because of our society is a unique dynamic in spiritual practice, that is, that the tradition is that the disciple and the guru will remain in one place. So the disciple was always with the guru, all the time. But now we have this dynamic of worldwide living, where the gurus travel to different places, make disciples, and then leave. And then they put their disciples under the charge of a senior devotee or temple president or something. And based on their evaluation, the spiritual master knows what's happening with his disciple. So this is a dynamic that is unique because of our worldwide world. So therefore, Shiksha is really prominent in our society. Very prominent. Sometimes more than Diksha. But as it's explained in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that the Shiksha Guru and the Diksha Guru are both equal representatives of the Supreme Lord. There's no difference. Because what is the purpose of Diksha? Diksha connects you to the Parampara. That's important. The Diksha gives Shiksha also. The Diksha Guru is giving you Shiksha knowledge. Shiksha simply means instructions. So you get Shiksha from Diksha and you get Shiksha from Shiksha. And as long as they don't conflict, then there is no problem from taking instructions from many Shiksha Gurus. As soon as there's some conflict, one must accept the principle of Shiksha coming from the Diksha Guru. Okay,
does
that help?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, one Prabhupada said when we were down, told me that I should never listen to the lectures of anyone but the spiritual master I was inspired by. Only just that one. And don't deviate or guilt your things that are outside of the teachings of your spiritual master. Because we all pass around so many lectures.
Well, it's nice to develop a cultivation in one way. Because as you cultivate the instructions, you also cultivate a relationship. But that's not generally an absolute principle. It has some validity, but it's not an absolute principle. Until one actually makes a decision and gets initiated, then one can hear from many. If you already chose your spiritual master and you're fixed on that, then why would you want to hear lectures from someone else?
Mm-hmm.
And why wouldn't you? You may, maybe you want, but not as a regular thing.
She said it's
if it's hard and fast like that, it's not exactly a principle. Because you go to many classes, and there's many gurus who come to classes, who travel and give different classes.
Yeah.
So, I'm hearing from so many anyway.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense. Obeying the orders of the spiritual master with faith and devotion. So why would one take a spiritual master unless they actually agreed to follow with faith and devotion? So that's the third relative. These are the 64 relative principles, which are foundational. And this is the beginning of the 64. We're getting them all now. They're all 64 listed in this chapter. There's 10 do's, 10 don'ts, and 44 other activities. Mm-hmm. 64. If you know all these 64, then you know everything. So then the third one is obeying the instructions, obeying the orders of the spiritual master, which is simply to have a spiritual master and to minimize or to change his instructions or to think, well, Guru Maharaj said this, and he also said this, but this is more important. All the instructions of the spiritual master is important. And if there appears to be a conflict, there's a question, then one should ask questions. There's apparent conflict in what the spiritual master may say, one should ask questions and ask for clarification. But otherwise, one must always obey spiritual master's instructions. Always. In fact, it's so strong of a principle that even if the spiritual master appears to say something different, still, because he's a bona fide spiritual master, is considered a genius. Bonafide. Of course, he will not say something different. But that, in other words, true devotees only know a guru. They only know their spiritual master. They don't know. They say, "I don't know the Lord. only know my Guru Maharaj, that's all I know. Whatever he says, that's my life. Whatever he says, that's my mercy. Whatever his order is, that's all I can think of. So one who is deep in the process of bhakti only knows that principle. And as one gets closer and more elevated, one takes more and more shelter in the spiritual master. Not like the impersonalists. For the Mayavadis, they say you have a guru and he gets you up to a certain level, then you don't need him anymore. Use the example of the ladder. The ladder gets you to the top and then you don't need the ladder anymore. The guru's the ladder. No, the guru remains with you even in the spiritual world. So, it's very strong out there. So, obeying the orders of the spiritual master with faith and devotion. Not just obeying, but I have faith in what he says, and I also am devoted to those instructions. Okay, fourth one.
Following in the footsteps of great acharyas, teachers under the direction of the spiritual master.
Yeah. Following in the footsteps of the great acharyas, that is, previous spiritual masters under the direction of the spiritual master. So one can learn the teachings of other the parampara through the spiritual master. One has to see the connection. This is a little bit more intricate because one may also see difference. Bhakti Vinod Thakur did one thing and Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati did something different in the same thing. So, but our spiritual master tells us what is the principle. For instance, Bhakti Vinod Thakur. Before him, up to Bhakti Vinod Thakur, including Bhakti Vinod, would teach the principle of Siddha Pranali. Siddha Pranali means who you are in the spiritual world. And that process was part of our tradition. But then when Bhakti Siddhanta came, he kicked it out. Because it was being misused and abused. People were arbitrarily and whimsically just adopting all kinds of identities. So, and there was a lot of sahajism, a lot of smartism, a lot of speculations. So in order to preserve the purity of that process, we kicked it out. So it wouldn't be misused. And Srila Prabhupada also followed in the footsteps of his guru. So that's not there in our process. Although it is a bona fide part of the process. So one has to learn the teachings of the previous acharyas through the present acharya. And not jump over to previous acharyas and say, well, they did it like this. Prabhupada said, you're getting Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati through me. But in the case of Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Prabhupada says, you can read his books. Generally, he didn't want us to read Bhakti Siddhanta, but he wanted us to read Bhakti Vinod. It's interesting. Because Bhakti Vinod Thakur is really, he formulated the whole process of bhakti in a little prophecy. He took Lord Chaitanya's teachings and practically applied it in this day and age. So, therefore, we follow that. We can read Bhakti Vinod Thakur's books, but we can't generally. We shouldn't try to read so much of Bhakti Siddhanta.
It's
so interesting about
progression.
Yeah.
If you go all the way back to
Madhacharya,
before him,
there wasn't even devotion to Radharani.
Yeah, it started
with Madhavendra Puri. Yeah. Radharani wasn't
included. So it becomes clarified with each creating of
Acharya. Yeah, because each is receiving Acharya's teaching on the basis of the previous Acharya's. Yeah, because the practice of bhakti is simply to take. Bhakti is a mature. Bhakti, when it's practiced by a pure devotion, is he takes the mature process of bhakti and, due to his realization, can apply it timeless to service. So that's acharya. Acharya is different from a guru. A guru is a teacher, but acharya is one who teaches according to timeless to service. He knows the dynamics of the climate and can practice accordingly without changing the essence or without deviating from the previous acharyas. Okay, that's the fourth.
fifth one, inquiring from the spiritual master how to make advancement in Krishna consciousness. So, this is something we don't do generally. People just don't do that. They get in a guru and they just go on. I want you to just occasionally say to the spiritual master, what can I do? How can I make it more advanced? What is it that I need to do like this? And then he will guide you accordingly. So that, in other words, that process of inquiring how I can make further advancement is one of the relevant principles. Once you do that, not just go on and never say anything, just getting instructions, but never really asking if there's anything specific. So that's self-explanatory. Okay. Number six, we want to read.
Being prepared to give up anything material for the satisfaction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sri Krishna, this means that when we are engaged in devotional service of Krishna, we must be prepared to give up something which we may not like to give up. And also we have to accept something which we may not like to accept.
Okay, self-explanatory. That there are certain things that we should be prepared to give up and certain things we should be prepared to accept. This is from the philosophy of service. Right off the principle, one should be eager to do that. Number seven.
Residing in a sacred place of pilgrimage like Dwarka or Vrindavan.
Residing in a sacred place of pilgrimage like Dwarka or Vrindavan. Is that always possible?
No.
So how is that applied in today's world?
Living in a place where the atmosphere of Vrindavan.
Yeah, living in a temple. So that extends like that. Once you. And what about people who live outside? Is that a principle applied to that?
Yes. If they transform their home in a place in the atmosphere of Vrindavan, the deities.
Yeah, they make deities the Lord is center in their home. That's considered. Okay. Number eight.
Accepting only what is necessary, or dealing with the material world only as far as necessary.
So the process of bhakti is simplicity, or what we say, accepting whatever is necessary to engage in devotional service. What is the verse from the Sri Upanishads?
Therefore, accept my those things, be agreeable for oneself, not accept other things, and then who they belong.
Yeah. Isha Vasha Midam Sarva, that can take care of the death. Tela Chitta Ina Bundi Jara Madhida Hatashi Sukhanam. So, read the translation. Everything animate and inanimate is owned and controlled by the Lord. And one should accept only their kola, knowing which everything belongs, knowing who with whom everything belongs. Isha, Isha Vashyam. One word, Isha Vashyam.
Everything animate or inanimate that is within the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as his quota. And one should not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong.
In the second, read the second verse, because the second verse is interesting.
Should I read the subject?
No, just the
second. One may aspire to live for hundreds of years if he continuously develops and working in that way, for that sort of work will not bind him to the law of karma. There is no alternative to this way for man.
So the point is that when it's lived according to the first verse, one can aspire to live a long and happy life. Generally, most people in the material world take more than one karma, and therefore they become implicated in the laws of material nature. And as long as you go beyond your needs, then you become trapped by Maya, and then you have to suffer. So Krishna, just like the father, gives the allotment to the child, but he doesn't give everything. He gives what the child needs in order to live. So in the same way, we have to take our quota. So then the question comes up, what is my quota? So then each ashram has its quota, according to ashram. So even within the ashram, then what the question would be, what's my quota? So generally one learns that simply by cause and effect, a trial and error. After a while, one can see how much food I need, how many material possessions I have, how much facility I need to carry out my service. One starts to learn. Then after a while, one starts to see that this is not necessary and this is not necessary. It comes simply by practice and sincerity. One has to be sincere to follow this principle. The process is yukta vairagya, but if yukta can become misused. Yukta vairagya means real renunciation, or renunciation to use it every day in the service of the Lord. If you collect the verses, apyahara means too much eating or too much collecting. If you collect too many material things, for just engage in the activities of devotional service and the modes of passion and ignorance, and we will never make So one has to honestly and regularly evaluate what do I need for Krishna. If I have, I have a dhoti for every day of the week, a sari for every day of the month, or something like that. There's too much. You wind up endeavoring to collect and to maintain. And then the emotional service becomes part of it. So one has to live according to the quota. And everybody's quota may be within the ashram. The ashrams are different. Obviously, the quota of the renunciates are not the same as the quota of the grihasthas. But even within each ashram, one has to, evaluate accordingly how much do I need. Because it's one of the biggest problems in this time is that people collect more and more things saying that I need all these things for my devotions. I need a car, I need a computer, I need this, I need that. You may use these things, and if Krishna takes them away, or if Krishna gives them, one is not, it's not then that they're not affected. They go on with their devotional service in whatever state of material, acquisition they may have. They may have a lot and they may have a little.
But isn't the key not what you end up with, but whether or not you're attached to it?
Yeah.
You use it in service of the Lord and detach it.
Yeah, that's the ultimate principle. But the other point is that even in that principle, it can get misused. I can use this in Krishna's service, I can use that, and pretty soon one is overcollected in the name of Yukta Vairagya. So one has to be careful, especially in Kali Yuga, where you don't take on too many things. And then after one's devotional service becomes difficult. Because devotional service requires hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord in association with the devotees. If we're not doing that sufficiently, then our devotional service will be somewhat slow. So if we have too much going on materially, then it becomes hard to hear and chant the glories. Okay. Number 9.
Observing the fasting beyond Kadashi.
Okay. So Kadashi means fasting, but generally Srila Prabhupada, according to the Western tradition, has given us the basic minimum, no grains and beans. But obviously, the tradition is to fast on Kadashi. But one should follow accordingly. And it's an old discussion on how to follow the Kadashi. But we don't want to go into it too much here because that will come up in the next chapter and we'll discuss that a little bit more. But observing fasting on the Kadashi. Prabhupada said, you know, no grains and beans, but in another lecture he says, you know, little fruit, a little milk. So, the reason why is that there are six pushes. You know the six pushes? What are the six pushes? Pushings. Things that are urges, the urges.
Is it
tongue, genitals, what is else? Anger, words, and mind. These are the six pushes. So these six forces are pushing for satisfaction. So one of them is the stomach. Stomach wants to be filled with food. So fasting learns how to control that. It gives you a sense of control on that. That way you can refrain from putting food in the stomach on that day, and then you can learn to control that urge. That's the benefit of fasting. Not fasting for some reason. It helps to play down that pushing, and it also helps us to develop clarity. When you fast, your mind is usually pretty clear, generally, unless you fast too much. If you fast just rightly, your mind is clear. When your mind is clear, then you can chant nicely. If you need to become clear. Sounds good. Number 10.
Worshipping sacred trees like banyan tree.
Okay, so of course we worship the tulsi tree. Sometimes it says worshipping sacred trees like tulsi and banyan. So that'll come up in the next one. So read the next paragraph, somebody.
These 10 items are preliminary necessities for beginning the discharge of devotional service and regulated principles. In the beginning, if a neophyte devotee observes the above-mentioned 10 principles, surely he will quickly make good advancement in Krishna consciousness.
So these are these first six are what? What are they called? They're called what?
Preliminary necessities. Preliminary necessities.
Or what's another word? Yeah, of course. Our dues. Things to do. These are the things to do.
First six or the first ten?
First ten. First ten are considered dues. Now the next ten are don'ts. So, 64 regulative principles are the foundation of all regulative principles. So, the next set of instructions is listed as follows. And someone can read the first one.
One should usually give up the company of non-devotees.
Okay, so, as I mentioned in class this morning, Asat Sangha, Avaishnava Chari. The first principle of a devotee is to give up the association of non-devotees. An association means affection for. One may have a relationship with the non-devotees, but on a formal or on a social business type. But one should not develop into a friendly relationship with our devotees, because then one will gravitate down in their consciousness based on that association. So one should rigidly give up the company of our devotees. So it requires an explanation. And the explanation is, Prabhupada says, association is affection for. In other words, not just physical proximity, but affection for. So sometimes in our dealings in the world, we have to be with non-devotees, but we're not associated with them. And then if we do develop a friendly relationship, it's based on Krishna consciousness. Therefore, you're not taking their association, you're giving them your association. It's the opposite. They're getting your association, you're not taking it. But it should never be that you develop affection for someone based on something, you know, other than Krishna consciousness.
Because the area of association with non-devotees also enters, for example, listen music for non-devotees or reading books by non-devotees.
Yeah.
Also.
In some cases, for preaching, we do that, but it's really not recommended. That'll come up in another regulative principle. You'll see here.
Yeah, it was interesting yesterday. I was at a devotee's house, but ended up watching a movie with the devotees. And it was not a movie. I mean, it wasn't, I didn't even want to be there. I mean, I had no way to leave. But it was so graphic to me because I hadn't seen a movie in like 5 years. So it was really a graphic example of what we're talking about. There was not a great association.
Yeah. Say, you said something. I was going to say something. What did you say again?
Oh, for, no, basically, giving up the position of non-devotee implies giving up reading books and non-devotee listening music. And then you talk about in the next chapter.
Yeah, this is
what we discuss this
time. Yeah. 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 So, I mean, that's pretty clear. One who is serious about Krishna consciousness takes up the association of the world. If devotees inspire you in the goal, non-devotees then create something different. Even reading other books and hearing other, that happens a lot in our Krishna consciousness, but it can also be very detrimental because it may reawaken something that is there in the past, and you develop an affection for something that still is part of our, you know, material desires. Okay. I mean, that's a big subject. One should rigidly give up the company. Prabhupada uses the word rigidly. Next one?
One should not instruct a person who is not desirous of accepting devotional service.
Yeah, because if someone is not desirous, if you instruct them, then what can be the, what is the result?
You waste your time.
That's one thing. And what's the other one?
Give karma.
Not so much. What's another thing that could happen?
Make it a karma.
Yeah, you can. You're getting closer now.
Prahlada Maharaj, when he instructed Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyakashipu became angry. And Prabhupada mentioned that there is a lot. Which explains that when we choose a person who not desire to accept, the reason is that he becomes angry.
Yeah. He becomes angry and he starts committing offenses.
So he commits an offense which allows him, which blocks his further progress in spiritual life. So in that case, we just give away a prasad. We'll just develop, you know, just say a few kind words and say, don't waste your time.
What about on book distribution? I mean, you get in many conversations with people. They might have a different understanding, different philosophy. They can talk to you for half an hour, 45 minutes, but they have no intention of taking a book. They're just looking for
something. You have to be able to perceive that. If you see that they're just trying to preach to you, if you somehow you have to use your intelligence and get out of that mess. Turn it around. You know how you turn things around? This is an easy way. Ask questions. The best way to win a conversation is to ask people questions. But people like to talk, and you hit them with questions, and then you defeat their answers. It's in our Prabhupada taught us that you want to defeat somebody, just ask them questions based on what they believe. Don't try to put your philosophy across if they're not interested. And then when they give their bogus answer, you just defeat it. That's it. And if you kill all their arguments, nothing's left. So when people get into these long things and you ask questions, and you divert their spontaneous pajama. You'll never get anybody to shut up. You ask them a question, and then sometimes it leads to them going on again, but then you ask them another question. Something you have to somehow or other be able to derail it.
That's a good tactic, because sometimes people, if you press them like that and ask a question, they don't have the idea what you're talking about.
Really?
And it becomes clear.
And most of the time they don't. Okay, one should not be desirous of instructing the person who is not accepting, for many reasons. Okay, number three.
One should not be very enthusiastic about constructing costly temples and monasteries.
Prabhupada did that. What happened? He didn't follow that, did he?
He wasn't enthusiastic about it, he was just practical.
Right. Very good. Practical, and at the same time, he did it only when he could do it. The Bhagavad-gita, of course, says one should not take on these projects if one doesn't have the means for it. And one should not be enthusiastic to do it for oneself. One should do it as a means for preaching. Prabhupada said, my spiritual master, he didn't open temples, but he wanted books.
Maharaj, now in ISKCON we have some big problems with two temples in Russia, and also we have some.
Yeah, big ones.
So, how do...
The one in Russia is interesting. But
yeah, and it is taken too much endeavor also. You know, of course the devotee will push on all the... They have the support of all the devotees around the world.
Yeah, I think in this case, opening that temple will be a major, major, major step forward in practice of Krishna consciousness in the world. Devotees need a temple. There's tens and thousands of devotees in Russia with no temple anywhere. No, there's only little namhats all over the place. No places where they're gathering, but no temple. And this will be a powerful blow to Maya, the temple gets open. That's why Maya's given such a resistance. Because that's another one. That's another big problem.
They have a problem now.
Yeah, I was just talking to Raj Mohan yesterday about that. But look what Prabhupada did in Bombay.
Yeah.
Major fight. And then look at that temple now. That temple is one of the most glorious temples
it feeds like 5,000 to 10,000 people a day, get prasadam every day. But, you know, like tens and thousands of people come every day to get darshan. It's a major temple. It's a glorious temple.
Like Bhaktivedanta Manor. That's all we've got.
Yeah, that was a good example. 10 years of fighting. Yeah. They finally won that fight, too. That was a major fight. So, as Prabhupada says, Krishna likes fights.
Are they fighting in Russia?
What's going on? The only way they're going to win is with international help, which they're doing that. They're trying to help from London, and from Britain, and from India. With international pressure there, you know, really. But if they have to fight without that. In London, they somehow or other, they mobilize the community and also the youth. The youth played a big part in explaining that. Come study the history. Hope somebody writes a book about this. Giriraj Swami is writing the history of the Bombay fight. And they'll come out soon.
Giriraj?
So he was in the media. He's writing a major book on that. But that was a real. I mean, that man who's tried to stop us, he was a demon. Papa said, "Lord, it's really good, killed him." Yeah, it's in Bhakti Chuma Maharaj's videos in Bombay. That was amazing. That guy was a demon. What he would do is, in India, you give people some land and you sell them, and you put certain stipulations on payments, and then when they can't make the payments, you take back the land and they don't get back whatever they gave you. So he used to do that regularly. He would sell the land, make it hard stipulations, they couldn't meet it, and then he would take the land back and resell it. So he'd sell the same property over and over again and try to be cheating devotees, people. So he tried that with Prabhupada, but he made a mistake. And Prabhupada said, one night, you know, during this whole fight, he had a heart attack and died. Mm. Prabhupada said, "Don't you sure you didn't kill them?" He was a demon. Prabhupada said, "Everyone will go back to Godhead except Mr. Nair." "Everyone will go back to Godhead except Mr. Nair." Mr. Nair was the man. And his wife, she continued to fight after him, but then she broke down and she surrendered to Prabhupada, realizing Prabhupada's spiritual potency. She couldn't do anything. And that was in Prabhupada, and that was a great fight. That was that took years of battle. It was an amazing fight. Sometimes we had the land, sometimes we lost it. Prabhupada was sending all his best devotees in there. They would blow it, Prabhupada would come in, straighten it out again. And Prabhupada was trying to do so many other things, and he was putting it in the hands of Tamal Krishna Goswami, Giriraj, and others. And it was a major fight. That was a major fight. When you read the book, once it comes out, it's exciting. See the history of this kind. Prabhupada went to build this movie. Anyway, Prabhupada says, when you get resistance in your Krishna consciousness, you should know that you're doing good. If you don't feel any resistance, that means there's no, it means Maya, you know, you're no threat to Maya. Anyway, it's an interesting fight. You'll see, you'll come when it comes out. Okay. So one should not be into anything but constructive. Okay, number four.
One should not try to read too many books, nor should one develop the idea of earning his livelihood by lecturing on or professionally reciting Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita.
So that's. One should, you know, concentrate on the main books, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Nectar of Devotion, Sri Upanishads and others. But one should not try to read too many books, because it takes away from essence. They're looking at me like, I got too many books in my library. Well, I stopped reading them all. I just got a big collection of unread books now. Now I can focus on Chaitanya Charitamrita. Next will be Bhagavatam. But one time I was interested in reading everything that came out, but then I realized it was too much. So one should concentrate, and then one should not try to make money, which is quite common for people, certain people in India. They're called Bhagavad Saptahas, 7 days, they recite the Srimad Bhagavatam, and then they charge money, and people come, and then they pay for their daughter's wedding and the money they make. So this is kind of, now you don't see this in the West, but this is what happens here. Number six.
Five. One should not be neglectful in ordinary dealings.
Yeah. Sometimes we think I'm too transcendental to be, you know, polite or neglectful or, you know, attentive. Too transcendental. No, one should be friendly and courteous and careful in dealing on this in an ordinary way. It's important. One should not be neglectful or, overlook ordinary dealings, because they're all part of devotional service. Nothing's ordinary. In other words, Prabhupada would, follow the social etiquettes also within the country that he was there. One should respect people and follow social etiquettes and deal properly in all levels. Number six.
One should not be under the spell of lamentation and loss or jubilation and gain.
Yeah. One should see all loss and gain is simply the same. Loss and gain are only loss and gain. Loss and gain are both the same, only different in name. Krishna gives, Krishna takes away. So I get something, I'm enlivened. There was that verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Do you have it? Turn to verse number 520 in Gita. 520. Good one. That helps us to understand this a little bit. Na parishyat priyam praptam no tujyat praptriyam priyam.
Sapriyam.
Stirabhu here, sammoda, ramavit pramanaspira.
A person neither rejoices upon achieving something pleasant, nor laments upon obtaining something unpleasant. Who is self-intelligent, who is unbewildered, and who knows the signs of God, is already situated in transcendence.
So, one should not be elated in gain, nor lamenting in loss. Happiness and distress. Okay. I'm trying to get through number 10 by the time this class ends, but I don't know if we're going to make it. We have one more minute. Anyway, we can stop here because you have to go to Bhagavad Gita. So, no questions this time. So what we'll do is, on Tuesday, review this whole thing, and then read the rest of the chapter on your own. Read the whole chapter, 6 by yourself, and then when the next time we'll do a quick review of what we did, and then we'll continue and finish the whole chapter next time. So this 6th chapter will take this time, and then I'll give you questions on chapter 6. Chapter 6 is important because it's the thing is how to do about that. So read the whole thing, and one of the things you can do is when you're reading it, as you're reading these 64 items, if you have any questions concerning anyone, write them down. So this will be your assignment. Write down any questions that's concerned with those 64 items that you made. So once you should carefully read the chapter. Okay. Any questions? Good. Mantra devotion is nice. It's interesting. The science of bhakti. It's a must. Prabhupada, we should read this book once, twice, three times, study it.
Lecture from Prabhupada, Mantra of Devotion. Does lectures do you have are systematically like?
Well, I don't. They're mentioned in the books. The whole lectures are transcribed. The books are called Teachings of Srila Prabhupada, the brown set, the seven volumes of books. All the Nectar Devotion lectures are in there.
It wasn't like a course that he did.
One thing he did do in 1972, for 1 month, when Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, he spoke on Nectar Devotion every day. He gave 14 or 16 lectures in a row. And then, in the course of the rest of the time when he was here, he gave lectures very, surreptitiously. But that 19, there's a whole, tape album of Prabhupada's tapes just on 1972, all the Nectar Devotion. And that was systematic Prabhupada tape. So you can get the tapes, or you can read the lectures in right in the books there. Good study. One thing we should find, sometimes devotees, do a lot of things, and that's nice, but focus on something and cultivate it. And that way you can be proficient in something. And then you can really be good at something and then be a teacher to others and really learn. If you learn one thing really deep, say you cultivate the mood of chanting, and you learn everything about chanting, read everything about chanting, and simply try to focus on perfecting it. And you become a charya just on chanting, and you develop realizations. And do the same thing with deity worship, or you can do the same thing with the Bhagavatam, or you can do the same thing with a particular pastime. So just read the whole pastimes of Prahlad Maharaj, learn all the verses, learn all the arguments, learn all the philosophy, and just be good at that. And then, if you just do that, you'll find that there's so much in that type of study. Now we just go to classes, we read, and we do a little here, and do a little here. But focus on something and develop it. You can do one thing, you can do the whole science of book distribution. Study book distribution. Study the history of it. Study the angles of it. Study the techniques. Study the philosophy behind it. And become a book distribution philosophical acharya. One can focus on something. It's like a person who's a professional. He may, in his profession, he just wants to know everything about that subject. But in Krishna consciousness, there's so many aspects to it. So you can get a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. That's nice. But after a while, as you stay in devotional service, you start to sort of focus in on certain aspects that really just attract you more. And that's good.
That's a very good idea, because we need specialists.
Yeah.
We need them for teaching
purposes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's very good for our own selves. And you'll find that as you learn one thing really well, you'll see how this spills over into so many other areas and how that helps you relate to so many other aspects of Krishna consciousness. Just like if you give a seminar and you just focus on all the information you need to prepare for that seminar, and then you sort of learn that
that philosophy and that presentation. And you become good at it. And you just can repeat it and explain it wherever you are. And then you can learn more about it too. Like I did that with Shiv Shastika prayers. I just studied them, heard lectures about them, read everything I could get my hands on about it. And then gleaned more and more information, and I just started to copy it all down. So now, you know, I'm just happy to speak about Shiv Shastika. Because there's so much to it. So you can do that with a set of prayers, you can do that with an aspect of devotional service. It's just so wonderful. When people do that with cars, they learn all about cars, you know. Mm-hmm. What kind of car this is, how it runs. You're always going to do that with Krishna consciousness. And when you go, if you give a class, you can give the same class everywhere you go. Yeah. You can speak about it. Just like Shama Sundar is going to come in a day or so. What is he going to talk about? Prabhupada. You know, he doesn't have a lot of philosophical knowledge of the books. I was just with him today. We had lunch together. And he was talking about, you know, he was seeing the verse that he had to give. He was supposed to come this morning to give talk. He's talking to his verse was too much. It's all about the modes of material nature. So Rama Swami was also there. He said, just talk about how Prabhupada pulled you out of the modes of material nature. So you can always talk about something in relationship to whatever subject, you know, you come in contact with. And Timur Krishna Goswami said that too. He said, I can speak about any subject on any verse. You can pick a verse, any verse, and you can connect it to any subject. So if you have a subject you're a master of, you can see the connection between that verse and that. So that's good. You just see what resonates, see what you find yourself attracted to. Just, you know, build on it. And people also will look to you as an authority in that area too. Give advice. Like I know there's one young man in New Vrindavan. He's the son of one. The man knows the whole Mahabharata.
He's talking about Jagannath.
He knows the whole Mahabharata.
He does.
Yeah.
He can speak about it for hours.
Okay, something to think about. Okay.